actually approaching God. Using the romance metaphor, I know that one approaches a woman thusly. This is a description of what happens and not a recipe or method. A. One knows that there is something between you that is worth pursuing. B. One accepts this and begins to think, plan, and act according to this knowledge, resting in the reality of it. C. One eventually presents oneself to the other person as being someone to be with. That's where it always falls apart if you're me. And D. You live lives that are now intertwined one with the other. Again, I think when I was a teenager and young 20-something, I was being encouraged that attempting B for real in this life, without trying to mostly fake it or help it along, was going too far, was too much to hope for with God. Christianity was stuff we knew, facts, doctrine, not stuff we could actually go for a ride in. It wasn't ready, didn't work in this life. We were to wait. And that didn't work for me. I believed the work of Christ could really save us, right now. So what I have to ask now is, if the above approach is how one might deal with a woman, why would it work any differently when connecting with God? Maybe it's supposed to go A, B, C, and D. Just like that, right now. The Gospel. Don Miller taught a class of Bible students in Toronto. He announced that he would give them a 40-minute gospel, but that he would skip one thing while he did this. They had to watch for it and tell him what he'd skipped afterward. So he started in. He talked thoroughly about sin and culpability, heaven, sin, hell, and sin, and all of that. He talked about the Christian responsibility to walk worthy of what we've been called to and not sin. The need to spread the gospel to others in a world characterized by sin. Then, 40 minutes in, he suddenly stopped and asked his Bible-taught students what he'd skipped. They had no idea. Predestination? Sanctification? Practical holiness? What Miller had skipped, in fact, in his gospel message was any message of Jesus at all. That Jesus came to earth for us, that he died, that there ever was anyone named Jesus, any of that. Yet removing Jesus from a gospel message without a room full of Christians noticing wasn't terribly hard for Don to do at all. They were used to the focus being on us and our sin and doctrine that focused on daily sin management techniques and reminders of our guilt and sin. As for me, my understanding of the gospel started to sound different from what I heard every Sunday evening. I increasingly felt like I was being forced to follow forms of godliness but not look for any power or workability in any of it, to claim to be saved and pretend to be, but not to look to really be saved from anything much at all. Certainly nothing I was wrestling with this week. I was supposed to try to do that stuff myself, by being devout, all of which rang increasingly false the more times I heard it. I needed to work out what the gospel was so that it seemed like good news. My grasp of the gospel. At the heart of Christianity is the idea that as human beings, we are imperfect and start out with a dysfunctional, disrupted relationship with a loving God who is worth knowing. A God who actually really wants to experience us and be experienced by us. A God who isn't just a rule giver, but someone who wants to create good in us, through us, for us, by us, all of that. Someone willing to send his son to save us. But the starting ground upon which we stand before God puts us in the position of someone who has made a false claim. That claim is that we are fine, that we can and will do and be good by ourselves. Actually, we're weird and weak. Our ancestor Adam having overreached for the knowledge of good and evil, there is now that expectation that not only do we now know good and evil, but that we can now actually reliably do and be good as a result. We know what's good, so of course, we can be it, right? There is the expectation that we are accurate images of God and that we can do just fine on our own and don't need God's help with anything. That's false ground to try and stand on. Makes us miserable. But we will be held responsible to come good on this claim unless we are willing to give up this ground rather than continue to vow to daily come good on it. God, for his part, loves us in a fatherly way and is quite willing to let us off the hook if we'll let him. But if we won't give up the charade, his hands are somewhat tied given how he chooses to work with us. In order for the two of us to meet halfway, we can't just continue stubbornly holding our distant, self-justified positions. We can't continue to be just fine. Because we're not, we need help to have things handled. Because we don't, we have to die to our rigid, inflexible, righteous vows, positions, and intentions, and be flexible and realistic enough to lay all of it aside and come to a central meeting point with God. If we want to let God into our lives, we have to lay aside our best intentions, the mere flesh we are, our religion, our rules, our image, our reputation, our human systems, our vows, and all of it. We can't rebel against our obligation, nor can we fulfill it. We aren't enough. There is rot at the root. We are weak and stunted and wounded and twisted deep down. We need Jesus. We need him so much. He came, he lived, he showed the way, and died in the position of a weak, flawed, dark-hearted sinner who needed to die, though he wasn't one and didn't. And then he rose again and is our advocate or lawyer with God. If we turn to him rather than being fine, God will, throughout our lives, transform us from the inside out into the image of Christ, who is God, fixing the problem that we are, without God, really bad images or representations of God. You want to avoid eternal perdition being lost like a deleted file or repercussions? You need to get to know God, rather than try to do stuff on your own like a five-year-old trying to drive himself to school. Jesus saves us, not only in the sense of rescues us, but also in the sense of saves to the hard drive. And it's not just about afterlife. Daily life matters. The work of Christ doesn't just start working after our deaths, or at the rapture, if you believe in that. It works right now. Good thing, too. We have to get through each day. And in terms used by Alcoholics Anonymous, we Christians again have to realize and admit that we have a problem and need help right now, too. We can't be fine all the time, nor fighting battles using our unredeemed willpower. We have to be born into an entirely new role, have to give up the old pattern of sometimes repeatedly asking Jesus to save us, then claiming to have been saved, but then living like we will need to save ourselves using rules because God won't, and kind of blaming God for not saving us when we're still weak, when we're still messed up. The lie in the garden is still with us, that God is holding good stuff back. So never mind him, we have to go get it ourselves, our way. We have doctrine, positions, and rules. We have vows, pledges, and promises. We have godly leadership and good teachers. Thing is, it's not that we choose Christ once and then follow rules. We don't have to stay the same, but still have to somehow follow rules anyway. We are not saved by keeping the rules. We are not blessed by keeping the rules. We let God and Christ flow into us each day so we can grow. And God changes us. In Sunday school, we sang songs about and memorized the Bible verse in Revelation that says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock." There are countless paintings of Jesus standing outside a door, waiting to be let in. The verse was presented to us as a gospel verse, as if it was for unchristian folks who really ought to see what a change is made by letting Jesus in. How sad that unchristian people left him out there. We Christians had let him in, and so he was in there with us. But Ruth pointed out on Facebook today that although we use this verse this way, in fact, in the context of the Bible, it is written to a group of true Christians, people God had a message for, because they already had a relationship with him, the assembly at Laodicea, the group who thought they had everything they needed in terms of doctrine, the ones who thought they were fine but weren't, the lukewarm, complacent, smug group. Jesus is standing outside the door of that church, knocking, not being let in, not being missed, by Christians who are busy doing church without the Christ. We spoke out strongly against Laodicea, of course, in our Bible study, and we felt that we were the approved Revelation Church, the one at Philadelphia. The one that was once in Asia Minor, named the City of Brotherly Love in Greek, not the one with Rocky Balboa and Tom Hanks dying of AIDS. We tried so hard to obey the Bible rules. If we slacked off on keeping the appearance of a Christian lifestyle going, we would find ourselves Laodicea before we knew it. I was starting to wonder what it would be like to just let Jesus take the wheel, so to speak, and stop allowing my church culture to backseat drive my day all year long. The Gospel of Legalism. Jake characterizes the Gospel of Legalism as,
"Jesus loves you, now feel like shit for the rest of your life."
When presented with this, legalists quickly respond to that observation by being more upset by his use of the S word than by the suggestion that another gospel is being preached among them, a gospel which says we are saved by grace, our choosing Jesus, but that then we are blessed, kept, and matured spiritually and win souls to Christ by our further choosing to engage in religious activity, by vowing to do so, and following through with our willpower. The apostle writes that if anyone preaches another gospel other than the gospel of grace, that they are to be accursed. And then he repeats that curse, cursed be. In Galatians, Paul says that he and the others did not submit to the legalists so that the truth of the gospel would continue among them, rather than another gospel supplanting it, a legalistic gospel. Later in Galatians, he says that he wishes those guys trying to force rules such as circumcision upon new, often Gentile Christians would simply cut their own dicks right off rather than bothering new Christians about their foreskins. But if Jake said the S word in front of a lot of Christians, they'd sure enough quote Ephesians to try to justify their acting like the Galatians were. This is why, I guess, I'm starting to take legalism so seriously. I think we always treat it a bit like a frat boy saying, well, Chet doesn't have a drinking problem. He's not a bad guy. He just gets a bit rapey and drunk drivey when he's had a few. He means no harm. And yet harm is done. I think Jesus and Paul take legalism far more seriously than we do. People keep telling us to take things like elections and military action overseas and abortion and gay marriage more seriously, posting fiery alliterative things on the internet with titles like Seduced by the Serpent, Yoga and the Devil's Door, and Coming Out of the Closet Under the Stairs, Horrible Homosexual Satanic Subtext in Harry Potter by Jesus Killer Rowling. And James firmly posts on Facebook,
"If openly active homosexuals are even allowed to participate in this forum, it will become the scriptural duty of every Christian to leave."
But I don't hear a similarly powerful, dogmatic chorus of voices telling us to take legalism seriously at all. I don't hear people teaching that it's dangerous or that it's anything that might concern our Savior. I'm always looking for people and books which do take it as seriously as they take things like yoga and Harry Potter. But I'm not seeing that same focus on legalism. I know, only I.